headlines are everywhere. Travelers stranded, shipments blocked, the doors to the British Columbia legislature made inaccessible by a wall of demonstrators. The nationwide solidarity protests that have spilled out over the past week all come back to one territory in northern British Columbia.
A tense standoff continues in northern BC today over a planned LNG pipeline, and it is forcing political leaders to address the confrontation between RCMP officers and members of the Wet'suwet'en Nation.
That's where oil and gas company LNG Canada want to build a leg of their massive Coastal GasLink natural gas pipeline. The Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs have said no, and they're not backing down. Now, they have supporters from coast to coast to coast.
In Victoria, protesters blocked entrances to the provincial legislature hours before the spring session.
The Mohawk Warrior flag waves over the train tracks in Belleville, the Tyendinaga Mohawk encampment now effectively disrupting rail service since Thursday.
And in Toronto, they obstructed a major intersection, bringing traffic to a standstill. Via Rail says it's been forced to cancel 157 passenger trains because of protests on the tracks.
Why is this happening? And how did a territorial dispute expand into a national conversation about Indigenous rights, reconciliation, and climate change? I'm Sarah Bosveld, sitting in for Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. I'm joined by Jesse Winter, a freelance photojournalist who's been reporting from the territory for Vice.com. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before we get into why this has been happening, what did you see on the ground when you were there for the past 2 weeks reporting?
I saw a lot of stuff. I think the overall sentiment that I kind of came away with is a lot of solidarity, particularly out on the front lines. Everybody is all on the same page. There's a lot of focus on taking the direction of the hereditary chiefs and sort of standing strong against what they see as an invasion of their territory. The first day that I arrived at the end of January, they were still sort of in setup phase. There had been this kind of slow-moving chess match where they had set up a blockade at kilometer 44, and then the police set up an exclusion zone, and so the land defenders set up another watch camp outside of kilometer 27. And so I arrived, and there was a pretty thin-skinned cabin with a plywood roof and plastic wrap with a big wood stove in the middle. They built a loft. They were working on building a kitchen. In behind that, they had some supporters had arrived with prefabricated insulated walls, and they built a little bunkhouse that also had a wood stove. And everything was sort of taking place there. Later that afternoon, I was able to make it up to the camp at 39 kilometer, which was later renamed Wolverine Watch in honor of a wolverine that had been sort of hanging around for a little while. And that was even more rustic. They had two wall tents, sort of a little lean-to at the front of the camp with a watch fire. Yeah, it was a very, very bush camp for anybody that's been sort of in northern BC. Very rustic.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, this First Nation is in northern BC. You mentioned certain kilometer marks. Tell me where it is exactly and how you get there. Like, was that quite a journey to arrive even the first few days?
Yeah, so in order to get there, say from Vancouver, you have to fly into Smithers, or I guess you could fly into Prince George or Terrace. Smithers tends to be the jumping off point because it's closest, and then you drive about an hour down the highway to Houston, BC. And then from there, you drive down this logging road. So you're passing like giant logging trucks loaded with logs. And that whole road is called the Maurice River Forest Service Road. And then it's along that road that these kilometer markers are sort of laid out. So the first camp you arrive at is at kilometer 27. And that was sort of the watch camp that was set up to monitor police activity and record what they were doing and coming and going. And then just past that was the police checkpoint where the police had blocked a bridge with two police vehicles. Further along to the kilometer 39 point is the Wolverine Watch Camp. And then even further at kilometer 44 is the Gidimden checkpoint, Gidimden Access checkpoint, that is where the raid last year took place. And then even further beyond that at kilometer 66 is the Unistaut and Healing Lodge.
So I want to get
back to that raid that you mentioned, but let's talk about why these protests are happening to begin with. That territory is the proposed site of a pipeline project?
That's correct. It's been over a decade now that this opposition has been taking place. Basically, what we have going on here is Coastal GasLink, which is a part of the LNG Canada project overall, wants to put a pipeline basically from fracked gas fields in the east all the way through the mountains through Wet'suwet'en territory to an eventual LNG processing facility in Kitimat on the coast. And that project has been permitted all the way through. They have agreements with 20 First Nations along the route, including five band councils from the Wet'suwet'en Nation. And that's where things start to kind of go a bit off the rails, because the band councils, according to the hereditary chiefs, they have a parallel governance structure that has existed since time immemorial. There's actually a Supreme Court of Canada case affirming that and laying out that their government structure is real. It exists. It has governed this land, but it exists outside the Indian Act. And so companies like CGL often decide that they're going to negotiate with the band councils because that's what the Indian Act says to do. And so there's this divide over who speaks for the Wet'suwet'en people. The hereditary chiefs say the band council has all the authority they need to oversee the confines of the reserves that the communities are on, but that outside the reserves in the traditional territory where this is all taking place, that's the purview and responsibility of the hereditary chiefs. And they say they've not been adequately consulted and they've not given consent.
So essentially, the protests that we're seeing in solidarity across the country, too, are in solidarity with these hereditary chiefs and the way that they view how these agreements do or do not stand with Indigenous peoples there.
Yeah, everyone seems to be in solidarity with the hereditary chiefs and their supporters.
This has broken through news headlines in the past week, and we've seen a lot of the ripple effects of this in the past weeks in terms of affecting roadways and train tracks and so on. But things have been escalating for a good amount of time now, and you did allude to that already. But what happened on December 31st, and what's been happening in the territory since?
So that was when an injunction that was originally granted last year in January, it was a temporary injunction. And there were arguments in the courts back and forth about whether to let it stand as a permanent one. So that happened. That was affirmed by Justice Church as a permanent injunction that prevents blocking access to construction areas for the pipeline. And when that happened, the hereditary chiefs and the leaders of the Gidimdin clan evicted Coastal GasLink from the territory. They said, that's it. You're out. We're no longer allowing access. And that's when the barricades started to go back up. And that all took place basically almost exactly a year since the original injunction was granted in January 2019, which is when the RCMP raided the camp at 44, the Gidimdin checkpoint camp, with assault rifles and militarized force. They broke through a gate. They arrested 14 people, made headlines around the world. And so this was sort of like the next stage of this decade-long controversy.
And you mentioned the province getting involved, and certainly now in this past week, we've seen some federal government reaction, although not from the top and from the Prime Minister himself. But tell me generally how the province and the federal governments have responded to this latest response to the injunction from December 31st.
Generally, the federal government's response has been to try and wash their hands of it and say this is a provincial matter. Trudeau's said that a number of times, and that it's up to Horgan to deal with. Before this last round of raids last week, he was on record as saying, I have confidence in Horgan's NDP government. At that point, John Horgan had appointed the former MP from the area, Nathan Cullen, who's also an NDP politician, as sort of a liaison to help try and broker some sort of peaceful resolution, and those talks went on for a couple of weeks. Horgan himself has been very careful to not speak very much about this at all. There was going to be a press conference yesterday in Victoria, but it got canceled largely because there were hundreds of protesters on his doorstep. Indigenous Reconciliation Minister Scott Fraser was on the radio today sort of filling in and saying it's his job to speak to this on behalf of the government. But all that Horgan has really said is that the rule of law shall prevail and the pipeline's been permitted and therefore these protesters need to move aside.
And why do you think they're acting so cautiously, I suppose, not stepping out, not making statements?
I think because it's a really contentious issue and it's a lot more complicated than certainly the rule of law shall prevail. And there's questions about whose law and which laws have the legitimacy and the backing of the people. There's a lot of argument that the Wet'suwet'en law is what should take precedence over the land, that the existing Indian Act and associated land planning regulations are colonial and have been imposed. And I think I think a lot of people, including the RCMP, are very nervous about the optics of all of this. They don't want to be seen to run afoul of the ideals of reconciliation.
Well, because both of those governments do talk a good amount about reconciliation, right? And then they also have these responsibilities to the economy. And those kind of come at loggerheads here, right? Like there's both of those issues and what the actual governance law is and whose it is all sort of mixed up in this whole ordeal.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a really awkward timing for Horgan and for the BC provincial government to have very recently passed the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People into law. That document includes affirmations that Indigenous people shall not be forcefully removed from their land, and that's literally what just happened. People have pressured and asked Horgan how to square that situation, and what he has said in the past is that UNDRIP is a future-looking document and that projects that were permitted under a regulatory process before UNDRIP need to take place under the permitting process that they went through years ago. But it's obviously awkward. I don't know how you can stand in the legislature and say things about reconciliation and UNDRIP and not removing people from their land while the RCMP are doing exactly that.
And this territory is not covered by a treaty, which is significant. So tell me what that significance is and how it affects all of this.
So most of BC, in fact, is not covered by modern treaties. I was speaking yesterday, actually, with Cliff Atlio. He's an Indigenous law prof at SFU, and he was describing how the land that we're talking about here in the Wet'suwet'en case basically exists in legal limbo, certainly in an international sense. There are court cases that prove that Indigenous title has never been extinguished, and there's one really important court case from 1997 called the Delgamuukw-Gisdaywe case, where hereditary leaders from the Wet'suwet'en and the Gitxsan nations went to court and fought for years and years and years to prove that their hereditary structures existed and that their hereditary leadership structures are intrinsically tied to the land and that they have title over that land. And they won. They did ultimately get a decision from the Supreme Court that affirmed their title existed, hadn't been extinguished. But there's an asterisk to that, which is that the court stopped short of finding a fact about exactly where the title is on the ground. So they said basically that in principle, yes, title exists, your governance structure exists, it's never been extinguished. But they didn't draw a map and say, this is the border of the area that you have legal title to. And that has set up part of this overall controversy.
And is that the significance of the checkpoints that they're trying to hold, the idea of actually plotting and standing at that land and saying, this is ours?
Yes, to some degree, that's what's happening. There, the Wet'suwet'en Nation is made up of 5 different clans and 13 houses. One of those clans is the Gidimdin clan. And so there's a reason that their checkpoint was at kilometer 44 on the road, because that's where their territory starts. And they're asserting their sovereignty over that piece of their territory.
Bring us back to the territory itself and to these checkpoints, to these camps, you know, that you already described for us visually. What have the interactions with people been like? You know, what is the feeling? What is the discussion around the nature of these discussions today?
When I was up there at the camp outside police lines at 27, there are a lot of supporters that are coming from all over the place. Like it's fairly incredible how broad the support network is for what the hereditary chiefs are trying to do.
How many people are up there?
It was sort of fluctuating. I would say there was a core of sort of 5 or 6 at that camp, which now no longer exists. That camp also got raided, and there were I think 11 arrests that happened there outside of police lines at a place the police had said was acceptable and okay for people to gather at. And so I would say a core of five or six, and then sort of a rotating cast of others who were coming, bringing supplies, helping build the camp. And conversations there were pretty free and open about, you know, what they thought about the RCMP being used to enforce an injunction that is meant to help a $6 billion pipeline get built. Inside the police lines at kilometer 39, things were a lot more tense. The land defenders were a lot more careful, especially around me, knowing that I was a journalist. And I don't often do this all the time, but on this assignment, I had a big press badge that I wore around my neck all the time so that anyone who interacted with me would know immediately that I was press and not be confused about that. And so they were very careful about what they said. There was also obviously tension and I would say quite a bit of apprehension about what was going to happen. It became pretty clear over my time there that the meetings were not going to resolve this, that the cops were going to eventually do what they did last year. And so the planning and the preparations at 39 were all around making sure that people were ready for that and emotionally prepared and safe in peacefully resisting what the police were going to do.
Sounds like a very tense environment. But they're also performing ceremony and really connecting with the land too, right?
Yeah, that's true. 2 days before the police raid, they had a woman who specializes in Indigenous trauma therapy come to 39, and she did a ceremony. There was singing, and she talked a lot about grounding yourself in the land and in Indigenous culture and preparing to heal from trauma that they were expecting to go through.
And let's talk about the reaction broadly to what's been going on in the territory and in the protests that have rippled out in support of what they're doing there. You know, there's a lot of like, this is Canada, like this is happening here. You know, we're not hearing politicians, you know, speak to this. We're seeing removal of force despite some of the laws around that not supposed to be happening at all. You know, this is Canada. You know, how is this level of force allowed? How do you respond to the way that people have been seeing this from a farther away?
I think it's interesting. I mean, in terms of the amount of force the police are using, there's this weird disconnect that seems to happen on the ground where, by and large, most of the officers that I interacted with were very polite. They weren't mean as they were restricting my access to photograph things. And there was this sense that, like, they're not super happy about having to do this, but they're doing it anyway. And so I think the RCMP, before the raids last week on Thursday, they had a press conference where they spoke about how this was not optional for them. There's a court injunction. They have to follow the court injunction. They gave as much time as they could to find a peaceful solution, and now we're going to carry out our orders. But at the same time, I feel like there's a lot of people that are reacting to that and saying, well, there are deeper questions to resolve here. There are deeper issues to deal with, and that maybe we need to deal with those first before we try and ram through a pipeline behind the barrel of a gun. That's a thing that a lot of land defenders have told me. And I think, honestly, that's starting to ripple across the country too, because I think people are getting tired of the rhetoric of reconciliation. And I think you see that in the number of settlers that are coming out and supporting. I met some of them up there in the up north. There were a lot of people here in Vancouver, in Victoria, at the legislature, all the way across the country. There seems to be, it's almost like Idle No More, if your listeners can remember that from, I think, 2013, but with a lot more support from settler culture, people like me. And I think it's because there's been a lot of rhetoric now. It's been years and years and years of rhetoric about reconciliation. But what needs to be reconciled are things like these governance questions and the hereditary structure versus the band council structure. And we need to actually start doing that work, not just talking about it. And I think that's why people are finally getting so fed up and saying, fine, then we're just going to shut down ports. We're going to shut down rail lines. We're going to let ourselves get arrested. And there have been dozens and dozens of arrests across the country now.
Yeah. And I know, I mean, we're talking to you from Ontario and there are rail lines here that are blocked. You know, Via Rail can't get passenger service across. CN Rail can't get passenger or their freight across. Tell me a little bit more specifically how, you know, settlers who are taking part in this protest are showing that support.
I think they're showing their support by being there on the front lines. The rail line that's currently being blocked, that blockade is in place mostly with members of the Mohawk of the Tandanega Nation, and they have a long history of this kind of opposition, and they've always been very strong in supporting other nations that are trying to defend their territory. But I think you're seeing it there. You're seeing it here in Vancouver with the number of non-Indigenous people who were blocking the port of Vancouver, which is one of the biggest shipping ports in the country. There's a lot of people outside the legislature in Victoria who aren't Indigenous but are standing with Indigenous people. And then there's also a whole network online of people amplifying the message and tweeting about it and posting live video or reposting video that's coming in from the raids up at Unistoten. There's a lot more people, I think, from what I can see anyway, this time around, who are doing sometimes very small things, sometimes very big things to add their voice to this overall push that is, it's about a pipeline, but I think it's also about the need to finally address the fact that we have 400 years of colonialism in this country or more, and it's time to actually start solving those problems or trying to resolve them anyway.
So what we have heard so far from the federal government as well, though, is the impact on the economy. And we haven't heard a ton yet about the impact on reconciliation. What do you think is going to happen going forward in terms of this relationship being affected by the protests in Wet'suwet'en and beyond? You know, what do you see going forward? Is there going to be a boiling point? Is this going to bubble over and push them into some kind of meaningful action on this?
I don't know. I think it could go a number of ways. We've seen little hints of what might come over the weekend on Vancouver Island. There was a blockade where a number of pro-pipeline people came out and got into arguments with protesters on the front lines. And someone actually drove a pickup truck right through one of the barricades. Thankfully, no one was hurt. But I think as the economic pressure starts to mount, if these blockades continue to happen, you are going to start to see some backlash. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if like the Yellow Vest movement and some of those like pro-energy movements in sort of the middle provinces like Alberta and Saskatchewan start to make more noise about this. But I think overall, the land defenders and their supporters have been pretty good about trying to find ways to resist and to disrupt that minimize the impact on everyday people and maximize the impact on corporations and government.
And what are we expecting to happen in the next few days at Wet'suwet'en and more broadly?
It's hard to say. The last I heard, there were still police present at Wet'suwet'en. Two Wet'suwet'en matriarchs were arrested on Monday, along with a number of other land defenders. Police have said that they are basically done with the enforcement action in that territory, although I would imagine that they will remain in place to prevent future blockades from going up. After the raid on Gidimden last year, the police actually built a detachment on the Maurice West Forest Service Road called the Community Industry Safety Office, the CISO office, and that has been in place for over a year now. I would imagine that it isn't going anywhere. And I think we're soon to start seeing construction ramp up again, although there is at this point still an outstanding certificate that Coastal GasLink needs before they can begin construction in the Maurice River Technical Boundary Area, which is where the Unistoten Healing Camp is. When I spoke to the BC government a couple of weeks ago, they said at that time that that certificate was still being reviewed, and it would be several weeks before they expected it to be granted. It's possible that it won't be granted, in which case we could be looking at months of delays for Coastal GasLink to start construction in that particular area, although there's already construction happening elsewhere along the line.
Do you plan to make a return up to the territory and bear witness again?
I think so, yeah, depending on what happens. I mean, there have been, since the enforcement actions on the Maurice FSR, there have been new blockades that sprung up, including a blocked rail line near New Hazelton. The Gitxsan Nation, which has always been a strong supporter of their neighbors, have blocked that rail line, and it's expected that there's going to be arrests there pretty soon if they haven't happened already. So it's definitely not over, and I'm definitely looking for ways to get back up there and keep seeing what happens.
We'll continue to keep up on this and as it develops. Thank you so much for spending the time explaining this to us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Jesse Winter is a freelance photojournalist. He's based in Vancouver. That's it for today's Big Story. To hear more, go to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also drop us a line on Twitter at @thebigstoryfpn. Of course, you can always find our episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, make sure you let us know. I'm Sarah Bosveld. Thank you so much for listening.